There's been a big movement to teach financial literacy in recent years, from politicians, schools, and the business world. But our next guest says financial literacy education doesn't always pay off.
Helene Olin joins us now. She's a journalist and the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Her recent piece, titled The Quest to Improve America's Financial Literacy is Both a Failure and a Sham, it appears on the Pacific Standard website. Helene, welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening, everyone.
Thanks for joining us. Well, how widespread is the notion that we need more financial literacy education for kids and grown-ups?
It is incredibly widespread. If you would stop and ask almost anyone what they think we need to teach in the schools, what we need more of, they would tell you financial literacy. Everyone seems to believe that there's some essential secret we are not teaching children and adults now, and that if they could simply master it, all of our financial woes would go away. As I discovered when I wrote Pound Foolish, that's just not true. And before you ask me anything else, I want to say that discovery just about broke my heart. I had begun to look at financial literacy as a potential solve for a number of our woes.
And you say that even the Great Recession was blamed, at least by some people, on a lack of financial literacy.
That's right. One of the things you've began to find over and over again is a kind of false equivalence, where you would see people say, and it would be everyone from, you know, people who had bought homes to all the way up at the high banks and government, that yes, these banks sold people this bill of goods when they got them to sign mortgages, but people really should have known better than to sign these papers that they didn't understand, without any understanding of the fact that we all have these. If you've ever seen a mortgage documentation, it's 100 pages, single, small-spaced, small print papers, and people are not reading it. And, of course, they're not reading it. Are you reading it? And you began to see this said over and over again, including by people at the Federal Reserve, the Obama administration, and my favorite was Bank of America, which got itself all sorts of trouble by buying Countrywide home finance, which was at the epicenter of the mortgage problems for the country.
Well, we said the headline of your piece up front there, saying that financial literacy education is a failure and a sham. Let's start with the failure part. What evidence is there that financial literacy programs don't help people deal with money?
Well, I'll go back to the beginning here for a moment. Financial literacy really began to pick up in the mid-1990s, and it began to be studied at the same time. So it takes several years for all of this stuff to come around. But what eventually started to come out over and over again was that people who had taken these classes at schools were no better informed about financial topics than anybody else. And before anyone thinks that that was found by someone who had an axe to grind, that was actually the finding of Lou Mandel, who was one of the founders of the modern financial literacy movement. Subsequently, you began to see other studies come along. There was a recent one out of the University of Colorado within the past year that found what they called a negligible impact on financial behavior, and that within 20 months, pretty much everyone had forgotten anything they'd learned. And there was also a study out of Harvard last year that also found that these classes had zero impact on anybody's behavior at all. What they actually found had some impact on financial smarts was increasing math classes in that case.
Well, could it be a case that we're just doing it wrong? We don't have the right kind of financial literacy, or, you know, we're trying to teach, something about mortgages to people in ninth grade and they're not ready to learn that yet?
Well, that's what the people pushing the concept like to say. And I should preface that by saying the people pushing the concept at this point are often the banks and the financial services sector, which has the most to be gained from this. Because essentially what is going on is they're saying, we don't need regulation to help people so that we could get mortgages they understand, and we can make retirement accounts simple so that people can actually use them. Instead, if we could just teach people to avoid the gotcha terms that we ourselves have created, all will be well. And that's just ridiculous.
And is that part of your concept that financial literacy isn't just a failure but a sham?
Yes, that is the sham of financial literacy.
But is there a right way to do it? Is there a, I mean, we'll get into the individual versus social side of the problem in a little bit, but is there a good kind of financial literacy education? Isn't there some way to help people navigate a complicated financial landscape?
Well, what you're seeing, where the small portion of it is coming in, is there's people now saying, well, we need to do this thing called just-in-time financial education. So the idea is that when you go to make a purchase of a home, they'll give you a talk on what mortgages are. Or if you go to buy a car, they'll talk to you about car loans. The evidence for this is somewhat mixed. In some senses, it does seem to help. But in other senses, you're beginning to deal with the fact that there's no standard regulation. So you see sites like my favorite being Ally Financial, which does car loans, which has an entire site devoted to educating their consumers that does not tell you what a subprime loan is, how to know you're being offered one, and what it would look like if you did get one, and why it is such an awful thing to have. So you have a basic conflict of interest problem. The second issue is that just-in-time is unfortunately something of a nebulous concept. What exactly is just-in-time for a college loan, for instance? Is it when you're signing up for the student loan? Or is it 10 years earlier when your parents are saving for college? What would be better? So you get into that part of the problem, too. Unfortunately, our financial problems are just greater than that.
We're talking about financial literacy education with Helene Olin. She says despite lots of calls for more of that kind of education, it doesn't, according to some research, seem to work.
And you can join the conversation. Do you want to make the case for teaching financial literacy? Is there a lesson that's helped you deal with money? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. We continue our conversation about financial literacy education with Helene Olin. She says there are a lot of people calling for more education on personal finance, but most of it doesn't really help us deal with our money.
You can join the conversation with your thoughts and your questions on financial literacy and how individuals cannot navigate a complex financial world. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll get your calls in just a minute. But Helene, first, I think a core point in your book and in the piece that we're talking about today is the contrast between these two thoughts. Financial problems are largely an individual issue. Financial problems are largely a bigger social societal issue. Can you talk about that a little?
Right. Well, there's always a push-pull. Everybody makes mistakes. But ultimately, where I came out on this was that when I looked at the data, our nation had a 10% savings rate in 1980. Today, we're somewhere between 3 and 4%. At one point during the last decade, we were actually at 0%. And the fashionable interpretation of that is we became a nation of wastrels and spendthrifts, and we didn't pay any attention to anything, and we suddenly lived for the day. And, by the way, we became collectively more ignorant to boot. That is actually completely untrue. What essentially happened was, is our financial world got a heck of a lot more complicated in terms of what products were being offered to us, at the same time as our salaries were stagnating and falling. And as a result, we began to stop saving money and turn to other ways to get by. And this, I should say, was completely pitched at Americans. People were told, invest in housing. You can get your way around income inequality this way. That was in Money Magazine in 2005. People were constantly told, you know, buy this stock, buy that stock. We have an entire network on television devoted to that to this day. So it becomes a sort of complex interplay. Do people make mistakes? Yes, we all make mistakes. None of us are perfect. But to assume that our financial woes are simply the result of ignorance is unfortunately not true. I wish it were.
We'll get to our callers now. We've got Nicholas to start us off in New Berlin. Nicholas, welcome to the show.
Hi. I'd just like to say that I recently had the chance to sit down with my older brother while he was making a purchase of a car at a used car dealership. And, I mean, we sat there for 3 hours and hashed it out. And I think it was a really great learning experience because I'd never really known kind of what, I don't know, all these financing, all these percentages, what it all added up to. And same goes with my parents. When I was 16 years old, my dad sat me down and had me do my taxes with him rather than just doing them for me. And I think that was a really good learning experience and helped me break my way into my own finances as I'm a starting college student.
I think that's terrific. And I am, by the way, all for that. And I think that is exactly how people learn. I don't think you learn it in a class. I think you learn it with your family by example and so on.
But a point you made earlier, even if we learn these things, sometimes we've got that 100-page disclosure document on the mortgage staring us in the face.
That's right. And that's the other part of this, though, is your family can set a really good example, but at the same time, it's not impossible to be fooled or switched and, you know, bait and switched. Call me in a couple of years when you buy a car and tell me how much you remember of going with your brother to this. And then we should actually talk to the researchers at the University of Colorado and see what they say.
But if we learn, maybe not the specific ins and outs, but I guess how about a skeptical attitude toward what is put in front of us by various financial institutions, that might be a lesson worth learning?
That's a lesson worth learning, but that's not what's being taught right now. What's being taught right now are basically, this is what compound interest is, this is what a mortgage is, this is what a mutual fund is. And as I said again, it's all self-interested. A lot of it is, we didn't actually mention this on the radio, but I do mention it in the article, a lot of this is actually provided by the banks and financial services themselves. So a lot of the information out there is simply not always accurate or not skewed in your best interest. We've found lessons on financial planning for school children that don't mention, for example, to look at the cost of investments, which is pretty basic stuff. Not, mind you, that anybody's going to remember it, but if you're teaching it, it should be there.
Thanks for the call, Nicholas. We'll go now to Mike in Green Lakes. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Just a great topic, financial literacy. I was a banker for a number of years, and then I was a mortgage broker for years, and I've been at 25 years in the financial planning industry now. And both my experience in banking and mortgage lending led me to become a financial planner because people are woefully unprepared for the products that are out there. But even more than that basic education, I would like to see us get to a point where we eliminate some of these very dangerous products, the liar's loan, and the subprime mortgage market. The idea that everybody has to own a house was so dangerous. Everybody needs some place to stay, yeah, but they don't need to have this huge mortgage and own a house.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
I agree. Yeah, I completely agree, and that's essentially my point, is I think a lot of this talk of financial literacy, especially by the financial establishment, is a way of preventing that sort of regulation and legislation from getting through, unfortunately. When you think about it, what's more effective, banning liar's loans or trying to teach more than 300 million Americans what they are and how to avoid them?
Thanks for the call. We'll go now to Jeff with us in Rhinelander. Hi there, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
I am a CPA, and I've actually spent some time auditing financial aid at higher education institutions. So I've seen the crippling effects that poor education can have when you don't know what you're getting yourself into in loans, particularly when 18-year-olds are taking out giant loans for education. I agree with you that maybe a course in and of itself in financial literacy may be well over the heads of children, but are there ways to incorporate financial literacy education into curriculums such as math, where you're giving real-world examples in textbooks about the dangers of credit cards with high APR and carrying balances, taking out student loans you'll never be able to afford, things of the such?
Well, I want to go back to one other thing to talk about the student loans for a minute. There is actually on record a number of the universities claiming that the main problem facing students right now is not the cost of higher education, but that they're simply ignorant about the student loans and what their impact is on them. That is just absolutely wrong. There is simply no way anybody could have planned for the cost of higher education right now. Higher education has been going up for the most part, at double the rate of inflation now for 30 years. To have expected anybody to have planned and anticipated that is a bit of a bogus assumption. So that's the first part of this. The second part is it actually used to be, prior to World War II, that that what we call financial literacy was indeed ingrained into the curriculum. Did it work? We really don't have the answer to that question. People were more financially responsible, but people were more financially responsible because, in part, the instruments that could get them into so much trouble simply didn't exist. So you couldn't get into credit card debt, my grandmother, for instance, because credit cards didn't exist. And when they did first exist, she wasn't able to have one until 1973. That was when married women got the right to have one. So there's a lot of complexities in this argument that sort of belie the simple solution we all think it is.
Helene, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Helene Olin. She's a journalist. She's the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Her recent piece titled The Quest to Improve America's Financial Literacy is Both a Failure and a Sham appears on the Pacific Standard website.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about some common verbal phrases that we like to fall back on, like, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but... And we'll find out what we're really saying when we use them.
First, Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources is proposing adding nearly 200 waterways to a list of those that don't meet water quality standards, with excessive levels of phosphorus being the main culprit.
The list already contains more than 700 bodies of water in the state. And while the DNR says most waterways are improving over the long term, getting a body of water off of that list is easier said than done.
Joining us now is Aaron Larson, Water Resources Management Specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be here.
How does a waterway find itself on this list in the first place? What are some of the criteria that are being considered?
So assessing water bodies against water quality standards is part of this overarching process that we conduct as part of the Federal Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act gives us authority to adopt water quality criteria. They range from chemical parameters, things like phosphorus, for example, ammonia, other toxic pollutants. And we also measure other indicators like indicators of stream health, like biology, things like fish or invertebrates that are, that occur in the streams and lakes.
High levels of phosphorus have been a major culprit here, according to some reports. What is to account for these high levels?
The source of phosphorus varies across the state. Phosphorus is a naturally occurring element, so it can come from just from the soils naturally, but there are human induced sources as well, things like urban runoff. So when it rains, the rainwater carries with it soil that's eroded from the landscape, and that has attached to it phosphorus. And so anytime it rains, we can get runoff that's delivered to our water bodies that can elevate the concentrations of phosphorus in the water.
And what about fertilizers?
Fertilizers, yeah, those are another human source. We apply fertilizers to farmlands to increase their productivity. Excess fertilizers can also run off during those rain events and end up into our waterways.
Are there other common pollutants that you're seeing showing up in our waterways?
The most common of the standards that we've assessed, phosphorus is the predominant one. Of the total number of listings that we're proposing for new water bodies to the list, 137 of them are water bodies that exceed the phosphorus criteria. That I should mention, too, that part of the reason that is that we are targeting specific water bodies that we suspect to be impaired for phosphorus. So we may have some indication based on preliminary data or professional judgment of the field staff that there are problems at those water bodies. We follow up with additional monitoring to identify the extent of the pollution.
Are you seeing more concentration of that type of pollution in certain geographic areas around the state, or is it fairly equal throughout the state? What are you seeing out there?
We really haven't done an analysis of the geographic distribution of these newly impaired waters. We have them throughout the state. We're finding these new listings throughout the state.
So give us some examples of some of the major waterways that made the list on your recommendation this year.
Some of them, I'm trying to think if there are major, I can't think of any major waterways that were added off the top of my head, but we do have, if you tune into our website, if you go to our DNR's main homepage, and you type in the word impaired waters in the search tool, what you can get is we have a search tool available where you can actually type in the name of a water body and determine if it's listed on our impaired waters list. So we do have these search options available on our website. People can look at the larger list of impaired waters and see if any water body nearby is included on that list.
Help us understand what this means for us in our everyday life. To what extent does a polluted waterway affect, for example, the water that we drink?
Well, next steps in terms of impaired waters, again, these are for surface waters. This list applies to streams and lakes, the surface water of the state. What the next step is in terms of management actions is essentially to come up with a restoration plan. So for each impaired water, we work with local partners to develop a restoration plan to identify what the sources are of the pollution, and then to develop a way to achieve the needed reductions for that water body to meet water quality standards.
You highlight that impaired waters every 2 years, that you're measuring this as part of the Federal Clean Water Act, and the law requires states to prioritize problem bodies of water and establish plans to get them into compliance. What does that usually entail, and who's responsible for making that happen?
The plans are typically, there are partnerships, as I mentioned, with local groups, but DNR is the agency responsible for developing these plans. They're referred to as total maximum daily loads. TMDL is the acronym. Essentially, those plans are what sets the allocations to each source in a drainage area, an area that drains to an impaired water body. We set up a list of all the sources and then assign those allocations to what's needed to meet the water quality standards. So, yeah, again, DNR works with partners to develop those, but we have the responsibility to develop those and then to submit those to EPA for approval.
The DNR has said that 75% of the water that that they monitor, that you monitor, is showing signs of long-term improvement. What accounts for that?
We have a number of programs that are in place that have helped to achieve water quality standards across the state. The 75% of the water bodies are those that we've looked at in this last couple of years and found that roughly 75% do meet water quality standards, which is a great success, I think, to have that level of water quality in the state. We have a number of programs, working with producers, farmers, municipalities to address non-point sources of pollution. That's, like I mentioned earlier, sources like runoff when it rains. We have programs in place to address those sources, as well as to point sources, like discharging, wastewater into streams and lakes. So those are permitted through our permitting program. And so we have, a combination of programs that are available, as well as funding opportunities, too, for people to receive funding to help implement some of these management practices.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure. That was Aaron Larson, Water Resources Management Specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, talking about a new report on water pollution in the state.
There are certain phrases and sayings that have made their way into our everyday speech that can seem harmless, but can cause a serious breakdown in our personal communications.
We're talking about phrases like, I want you to know, or I'm just saying. Here to explain how these seemingly innocent turns of phrase can mean something more sinister is Elizabeth Bernstein. She wrote about this in her column, Why Verbal Tee-Ups Like To Be Honest Often Signal Insincerity. She writes a relationships column called Bonds for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
What phrases are you talking about when you say verbal tee-ups?
I'm talking about these phrases that seem really polite, and I think maybe on the surface we may think we're doing them for a polite reason, but subconsciously we aren't. They're saying something else if you read between the lines. So these are phrases, the one I hate the most is, don't take this the wrong way. I just can't stand that one. Or, I'm just saying, as you said, or to be honest, those kinds of things.
And how do they change the meaning of what's coming next? Or can you even pay attention to what's coming next after that preamble?
You can't. What they do is they're signaling to the listener, whoa, you better be careful here, because something that's coming next is something I'm uncomfortable telling you. That's really what I take away, and the researchers say they will really take away from this. So, for example, to be honest. Well, why do you have to signal your honesty? If you're really being honest, why do you have to, you know, say it? It makes the listener tense up and think, wow, like, if this person's being honest now, are they always being honest other times?
Well, how can they break down how can they cause a breakdown in communication? And they seem so harmless.
They seem harmless. They seem very polite. And also, it's interesting, since I wrote the article, a lot of people wrote me from all over the country saying, oh, we have regional ones. I heard all over the South people wrote me about, bless your heart. And I said, well, give me an example of that. And they said, well, bless your heart, you've gained a little weight. So it's something that, you know, you think you're, you know, it's like, I don't hate me or slug me for what I'm about to tell you. It was really. And then in Boston, they wrote and they said, oh, we're big on this one. Not for nothing, but. I never heard that one. Not for nothing, but. Gained a little weight.
Wow, the bless your heart one is new to me.
Yeah. Right? It's not. I'm a Midwesterner, and that one was new to me, too.
And this, it's always signaling, I'm going to tell you bad news. I'm maybe trying to signal that I don't want to be. In fact, there's the one, I hate to be the one to tell you this.
Yeah, I hate
in
to be
fact,
the one to
it's
tell you.
Probably the opposite. I'm quite pleased to be the one to tell you this. In a lot of the cases, is what really happens, isn't it?
Exactly. They can't wait to tell you whatever it is. Let's just stick on the weight. You gained a little weight, but I'm only telling you this because I love you. That one is pretty much almost the worst one because you really love the person. You might think of their feelings first, and the harm that whatever you're going to tell them is going to do.
But thinking about it from the speaker's perspective, I suppose. Don't these tee-ups make it easier to be honest? You know, you don't want to be the one to say it, but someone's got to say it, and it makes it easier for me to say it when I soften the blow a little bit with a little bit of a preamble.
Well, that's just it. We think we're softening the blow. The speaker does think, I'm softening the blow. I feel like I need to say this. I'm going to soften the blow. But it's not really softening the blow because we all know, and these have been around forever. We actually got a letter from Ralph Nader, said, look, you know, my mom wrote about these 30 years ago. So she wrote a column about them. So, you know, I'm not saying anything new. I'm just saying it again for our generations now. But these are things that the listeners know. It's not going to go well. And I started my column by saying, you know, I had a friend who said to me, I was all dressed up. We're at a party. I'm all excited. I'm happy to be there with my friends. He says, listen, don't take this the wrong way. And I couldn't hear anything else. I just knew whatever it was going to be so awful. And whatever it was wasn't that great. But you know what? It would have been a lot better if he just said, hey, there's something I need to tell you, or just blurted it out.
Are we bad people when we say these things? Are we really thinking we're being nicer? Are we taking a moment to relish in saying something bad? What does it say about us when we say these things?
It says people are not really thinking. So some people may use this. You know, I don't take this again. Don't take this the wrong way means don't be mad at me. And the reason it's so nasty is because it's saying it's taking away the listener's right to have an actual feeling or reaction about what's being told to them. So not only am I going to tell you something bad, but you don't even have a right to be upset with me about it. So that's from the listener. From what you asked about, you know, from the speaker, we're not thinking. Some people are. They think, okay, if I say bless her heart and I bring, you know, I invoke God into this, then I'm, you know, I've got a free pass. I can say anything. That's not true. And so we need to think about what we're saying, think about our speech. We should be careful with it. Words, you know, words are mean a lot. And we're just not thinking when we do it.
Why did one expert that you spoke to equate politeness with deception?
Well, he's somebody at University of Texas. He studies language and lies. He studies lies as well. And he says, you know, when we're being really polite, yes, there's a need for it. It's sort of social grease. We do need to be polite. You know, you can't really say, you know, to your spouse, no, honey, I hate your haircut, you know, or you're losing a little hair. Or you can't really always say everything what you want to do. So politeness has a function. But if you think about it, much of politeness is fakeness. We might really be thinking, gosh, like that haircut is not working. So we just, it's necessary in some ways, but, and it's very helpful for society to get along, for civilization, but it's not the truth either.
Okay, sometimes, though, we honestly do want to communicate something unpleasant to a person. How do we break ourselves of the, to be honest, or I hate to be the one to tell you this, those preambles, and just come out and say it? How do we fix this?
Well, I think if you think about, you know, the fact, okay, I have to say something really difficult to somebody I care about, you know, you can't, I don't get off the hook for doing that. I have to do it, so I have to sort of take the lump with it. So I need to say to them, just as you said it really, hey, do you have time to talk? There's something I really want to tell you, but it's hard for me, or something like that. Be honest. Don't say, you know, don't take this the wrong way. Or,
wait, is that any less scary? I really need to have a serious talk with you, man. I mean, that doesn't sound any less threatening than I hate to tell you this.
Do you have time to talk? That'll get their attention. And in fact, what's so funny is marital counselors say all the time that spouses, especially wives, should say this to their husbands. Do you have time to talk? When they want to talk about something important or something that might be emotional, because men are they're focused on one thing, it tends to be at the time, like research would back me up on this, and they don't like to be hit up when they're, you know, busy doing whatever it is, work, watching the game, fixing the car, whatever it is they're doing. They don't want to be slammed with a big relationship talk. So, you know, do you have time to talk is almost always a good thing to say.
Another thing, if we see ourselves saying those things, you know, I want to be honest with you or whatever too often, does that mean we're just saying bad stuff to people too often and we need to triage what we fill them in on?
Exactly. If you're running around saying that, you may, you know, have this false notion that, you know, because I'm giving these tee-ups, the, you know, preamble to it, I think I'm giving this information gently, but maybe I should think about the actual information that's coming after these phrases. Like, does it really need to be said, or could it be said in a different way? In the instance of my friend who said, don't take this the wrong way, it was something that probably needed to be said, but it should have been a conversation, not a one sentence here. I got something bad to tell you. Now I don't want to hear anything you have to say. That's what it's saying. I don't want to hear your reaction. Just going to throw this at you. So we should be thinking about what it is we're really saying, you know, after these little phrases.
Elizabeth, you've studied, you know, relationships. You've written about it for a while, and I'm sure you've talked to many experts about this as well. I'm wondering if you have heard of this happening more maybe in the Midwest, where people are stereotypically more polite,
nice.
Yeah, nice, quote unquote, and might be more prone to using verbal tee-ups like this versus, say, the East Coast?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't see any research on that, but my gut would say yes. You know, in the areas where they, you know, do put a very big, you know, premium on being polite, it's, and they're less abrupt, they're more sort of quieter, really. So, you know, say Wisconsin, Minnesota, these are quieter cultures, really, than maybe New York or L.A. So, yeah, I think that they might. I really got a sense through doing some other radio shows that were national that in the South this is huge, like that it also is a culture that's very, very much the Southerners calling in were telling me, you know, this we're very polite, but it's almost a fake politeness. We're raised to say things other than what we're thinking.
Elizabeth, bless your heart, but I think it's got to be hard to be you. You write about this stuff, and now are you constantly watching yourself and catching yourself about
it's
to say these
terrible.
Things?
Terrible. And my family just calls me on it left and right. It's just awful. My friends, did you just do what you said not to do? Yes, it's tough to be me. And Ralph Nader is calling to scold me or emailing to scold me. So it's tough.
Is social media changing the way that we use tee-ups? Real quickly in our last minute here.
Yeah, it is. I think it is because we are, look, we're saying all these things. We're so used to, look at Facebook, it's 10 years today, their birthday. But also we say everything on there and we get in these fights, especially around the time of the elections. You know, we get in these fights about stuff. And so we, again, start to think, oh, well, if I just preface it with, you know, to be honest, you're an idiot. I think I said it better.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Bernstein is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. You can find her on Twitter at EBernsteinWSJ. She was with us to talk about her column, Why Verbal Tee-Ups, Like to Be Honest, Often Signal Insincerity, and she writes the Bonds column for The Wall Street Journal.